KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Yurok Tribe and the Palaban and Mission Indians are hosting this year's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Peoples Summit. It will take place in Pala, California, Tuesday and Wednesday. This is the third year the summit will be held. The event brings together tribal leaders, advocates, lawmakers, and law enforcement to address MMIP in the state. Yurok Chairman Joseph James says the summit addresses the root causes of the MMIP crisis, which he says is an unfortunate issue that negatively impacts every Indigenous person in the state. This year's summit will feature a youth panel, cultural sharing, and testimony from families. Topics include sex trafficking, the implementation of a statewide missing Indigenous person alert, and culture as healing. According to the tribe, California has the fifth highest rate of MMIP cases in the U.S. The summit is intended to help identify actionable, tribally driven solutions to combat MMIP. The devastation from January's Los Angeles wildfires is a reminder that extreme wildfires burn year-round. The Washoe Tribe of Nevada and California is working to reintroduce intentional cultural fire meant to restore forest health and reduce explosive fires. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Bradle has more.
It's a sun-splashed afternoon in a forest near South Lake Tahoe, where large fir and pine trees stretch into the clear blue sky. Here, there are dozens of tribal members eager to learn about cultural burning. But first, they have to learn how to control and put out fires. That's why a group is huddled around a heavy-duty water pump with two thick fire hoses connected to it. One is in a tub of water, the size of an above-ground pool, and the other is unraveled a few dozen yards away. Jeremy Miles Placencia is with the U.S. Forest Service and leading the demonstration.
We have everything connected. We have our discharge hose. Now we can set up the fuel line.
And then he revs up the water pump. Water pushes through the extended hose like a snake coming to life. Now participants can practice spraying pressurized water as if they were putting out a fire. One person soaking up that knowledge is 30-year-old Kyle Tabor Cooper. He's a member of the Nooksack tribe in Washington State, but lives in northern Nevada and is engaged to a member of the Washoe tribe.
I've met a lot of people that have inspired me to like get into this training and just show me like a different kind of way, like with cultural, intentional fire.
Cultural fires are restorative, not destructive. They're typically done on a smaller scale to take care of traditional medicine plants or other cultural resources that rely on fire.
So for example, the Washoe tribe, our first two burns were burning a willow patch.
That's Rihanna Jones, the director of the Washoe tribe's Environmental Protection Department.
Washoes are famous for their baskets, making beautiful baskets. So when you burn the willows, they grow back better, straighter, with less secondary nodes.
But the Washoe tribe wasn't allowed to burn for more than a century. That's because of longtime colonial federal policies that prioritize suppression or putting out fires as soon as they start. Jones says that has hurt tribes and the health of many forests.
Fire suppression is like indigenous culture and indigenous people suppression as well. You know, they were not interested in, I think, learning from indigenous people.
But that has started to change over the last decade. Now, many federal fire officials say decades of keeping fire off the land caused a buildup of highly flammable dead trees and brush, turning many forests into a tinderbox. And rising temperatures and drier conditions are adding even more fuel. A 2021 study led by UCLA found that climate change has been the main driver of the increase of fire weather in the West.
Climate change has had a huge effect with respect to drought, increase of pests and pathogens, and then increase of wildfire. So we're having these catastrophic huge wildfires coming through that we can't keep up with.
I'm Caleb Radel.
This story was originally produced for the climate radio show, Our Living Lands. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
See Renewal's expertise in energy, housing, land use, fire protection, and more in multi-jurisdictional environments helps tribes leverage existing assets, grow capacity, and gain competitive advantage. See Renewal supports this show. SEERenewal.com.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com. Enbridge proudly supports this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
It's an emotional subject, and people want a very clear answer, and right now there's not any clear answers.
The University of Alaska Board of Regents votes to remove all references to DEI. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, February 24th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, Governor Dunleavy files a controversial bill to allow finfish farming in Alaska's inland waterways.
Pursuing freshwater finfish farming of any kind is a foot in the door for salmon farming in Alaska.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The North Slope Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will hold a public meeting in Utqiagvik on February 27th and 28th to develop federal wildlife proposals and discuss other subsistence-related issues. For more information, visit us at doi.gov/subsistence/regions. Call 800-478-1456 or find us on Facebook at Subsistence Alaska. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
The University of Alaska system will no longer use or refer to diversity, equity, inclusion, or other similar words on its websites, print, or electronic communications, programs, and positions. That's after a vote by the system's Board of Regents, who say they're still committed to offering an inclusive educational environment. KDLL's Ashlyn O'Hara has the story.
It was toward the end of 2 days of meetings at Soldotna's Kenai Peninsula College that Board of Regents Chair Ralph Seekins appears to veer off script.
Are we ready for this? Here is a motion that we will make that, if I'm correct, we need to make the motion to approve this. And it is hopefully very clarifying in the minds of a lot of people that are watching to see as the board goes forward.
Seekins looks to Regent Seth Church across the room, who starts to read a motion that wasn't on the board's agenda.
I move the Board of Regents direct the president to take all necessary actions to comply with recent federal executive orders and applicable agency guidance.
Those recent federal orders come from President Donald Trump, who's put diversity, equity, and inclusion policies squarely in his crosshairs. And according to the Board of Regents, those necessary actions include scrubbing university websites, employee position titles, programs, and communications of the words diversity, equity, inclusion, and, quote, other associated terms. A preamble to the motion says the board reaffirms its, quote, dedication to being an inclusive, non-discriminatory institution and to continue honoring Alaska Native communities. Seekins underscores that before the vote.
In a nutshell, we're asking this university be a welcoming, open-access university, discrimination toward none, and opportunity for all.
The Board of Regents is putting enforcement of the new policies in the hands of university chancellors, some of whom sought clarification on how they should be responding to the federal orders. One of those chancellors is Sean Parnell, who oversees the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Yesterday, I asked for clarifications because I felt like our employees deserve more certainty about direction, and I could only provide so much as chancellor of one university who answers to the president and the Board of Regents.
He says part of the confusion stems from the university system's historic embrace of diversity initiatives.
There have been strong policies in the past from Board of Regents which utilize some of the terms, the DEI terms that are now, you know, not supposed to be used according to President Trump's orders.
University System President Pat Pitney says the motion was really about ensuring none of their existing policies or programs appear discriminatory. And she says that work started before this week's board meetings. Pitney says the board is trying to reaffirm the university system's openness to all, rather than perceived restrictions to some.
It's an emotional subject, and people want a very clear answer, and right now there's not any clear answers. And so the best we can do is focus on our welcoming environment for all.
But not everyone thought Friday's motion was the right move. Monique Musick, who's part of the University Staff Alliance, cast doubt on whether the motion actually provides clarity.
I think I'm probably going to be spending a lot of the next few months trying to define that as we try to meet this and finding every way of removing diversity, equity, and inclusion and other associated terms from our jobs, from our research, from our clubs, from our activities. I mean, where does this end?
While the board voted, a federal judge blocked significant portions of Trump's DEI orders after determining parts violated the U.S. Constitution. After the meeting adjourned, the university system's director of public affairs said he hadn't yet read about the ruling, but that the language passed Friday is meant to give general clarity to university staff. He said board members will take new developments into account. Reporting in Soldotna, I'm Ashlyn O'Hara.
Governor Mike Dunleavy introduced a bill Friday that aims to reverse Alaska's ban on finfish farming. Alaska currently only allows aquaculture for shellfish and kelp. Dunleavy says the bill would allow farmers to breed and develop finfish stocks, although salmon farming would remain prohibited. But some lawmakers are pushing back. State Representative Louise Stutes, a Kodiak Republican and chair of the House Fisheries Committee, told legislators during a Monday floor session that the bill could put Alaska's wild fisheries at risk while the industry is struggling.
Lifting a ban on fin fish farming, regardless of which species, regardless of saltwater or freshwater, would be sending the wrong signal to the industry, fishing communities, and fishing families across the state that are struggling currently to recover.
The bill faces significant hurdles in the state legislature. Stutes, along with House Fisheries Committee Vice Chair Bryce Edgman, released a statement this morning opposing the bill. Fish farming was outlawed in Alaska in 1990, following widespread opposition from lawmakers and the public. And though the bill excludes salmon farming, Stutes warned it could set the stage.
Pursuing freshwater finfish farming of any kind is a foot in the door for salmon farming in Alaska.
The global aquaculture industry is worth more than $6 billion. China leads the sector, producing about a third of global output, according to a 2024 study from the United Nations. The U.S. produces about 2%. Dunleavy's proposed bill would limit fish farming methods to, quote, inland closed system bodies of water. Alicia Bishop is the regional aquaculture coordinator for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She says that means stocked ponds and fish tanks.
We're not talking about open water cages or any other cultivation method like that. So this would be, you know, on land, closed ponds, or recirculating aquaculture systems.
The bill also requires any farmed fish be sterilized, so they couldn't reproduce if they did escape the tanks. Still, its path and any current support in the legislature remains unclear. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Maine musher completes a recreation of the historic 1925 serum run that saved Nome.
Anyone can do the Iditarod. Not everybody can recreate the serum run with Togo's lineage.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know 100 years ago, the chances of a baby dying in Alaska before their first birthday was almost 10%? Because of advances in public health like sanitation, access to clean water, vaccines for children, and access to health care in rural communities, the chances of dying are now less than 1%. To learn more about what the Alaska Department of Health is doing to improve Alaskans' health for the next 100 years, visit health.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
A Ketchikan educator was named as the state's Principal of the Year. Sherry Bollert is the principal of Ketchikan Schoenbar Middle School. The title is given by the Alaska Association of Secondary School Principals. Dominique Johnson works with the statewide association of principals.
It's a great recognition from her colleagues statewide and the region, and it just shows the great work she's done over her years as a principal.
Bullard has taught in Ketchikan her entire career, first as a teacher and principal at Point Higgins Elementary, and then as the Schoenbar principal for nearly a decade. While she was principal at Point Higgins, the school received a National Blue Ribbon Award for Excellence in Public Education. Johnson says the winner of the Principal of the Year Award is first nominated by their peers. Then, educators elect regional winners. The board of the Statewide Association of Principals then selects the Alaska Principal of the Year from those 8 regional honorees. Bullard says the award is really exciting, especially because it's, quote, not often that Ketchikan draws attention at the state level.
I really believe that while it names me as Principal of the Year, that it's really it's recognition of, like, my whole staff, because you don't get here by yourself.
Rick Dormer is the board president of the Statewide Association. He's also the principal of Ketchikan High School. He said in a statement that Bullard makes sure every staff member and student feels valued. The state's commissioner of the Department of Education, Dina Bishop, echoed this. She said that Bullard's dedication to her school and community should make Alaska proud. Bullard is also in the running for National Principal of the Year. She will head to Washington, D.C. this fall to represent Alaska at a national summit for school principals. Skagway held a protest in support of one person who represents thousands. Participants rallied against what is believed to be the first Skagway casualty of the National Park Service staff reduction. KHNS reporter Melinda Munson attended the event, which drew around 30 people outside the local National Park Visitor Center.
We support our national parks!
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 On Valentine's Day, Skagway's only historic preservationist for the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park was terminated from his job. The firing appears to be a result of a new federal policy to shed employees of the Department of the Interior who are new to their jobs and still in their probationary period. This can include longtime workers who recently accepted a promotion. And that's the case with Skagway's Jesse Gilliams, who was the park's historic preservationist. He is a carpenter who spent nearly a decade receiving training and education to rehabilitate historic buildings. He recently accepted a promotion and was nearly finished with his mandatory probation period when he lost his job. Gilliams did not wish to make public comment, but the community stepped in and spoke for him, like Anna Nelson.
I am so disgusted at what is happening in our government, just the fact that they are so blatantly disregarding all the important work that is done by these federal workers and acting like they are nothing but a nuisance and an unneeded expense. And there's just no humanity in it. This money is not going back to us, this money saved. It's only going to the billionaires.
Residents held stiff signs in the wind that read, "Jobs are not handouts. Stop the assault on American civil servants. And resist tyranny."
This is what democracy looks like!
This is what democracy looks like!
They marched through downtown Skagway, covering 7 blocks from the Park Service Visitor Center to City Hall. A handful of Park Service employees watched the event unfold from their cars. Much of downtown Skagway is owned by the Park Service. In the summer, thousands of tourists a day clump across the wooden boardwalks. Stepping into the town is like entering the set of an old Western with tall, brightly painted, false-fronted wooden structures. Visitors can pan for gold or take a guided walking tour with an 1898 Lady of the Night. The Park Service runs several museums scattered across town, and it's one of the few year-round employers. Residents are concerned that without a robust park service, an important cultural aspect of the town will disappear. Longtime resident Liz Lavoie helped organize the protest.
It's important that we think about our community and what it looks like without a high-functioning park service. What does this summer look like without them? This is the first shockwave that hit Skagway, but there are more to come.
Tour operator Sherry Corrington shares the concern.
We have so many federal workers in our community. They're all very nervous about their jobs, their security. So as I stand on this corner with all these other people, I don't feel anger and rage. I feel the love and connection of the community.
Now it's winter, the off season, which means the local population has shrunk to around 800 people. and some of those are vacationing in warmer climates. Does holding a rally on a nearly empty street in remote Skagway make a difference? Liz LaVoie says yes.
I think communicating ways to have tiny acts, tiny acts of resistance, whatever they may be, they add up and they're cumulative.
Skagway resident and distillery owner Jenilyn Hager agrees.
This matters. I know it's effective, even in a little town like this. So vote with your dollars, hold up your signs, make your phone calls. You know, resisting matters.
It is unclear how a park that is built around historical buildings will function without a historic preservationist. Questions to the official media contact for the Park Service went unanswered. In Skagway, I'm Melinda Munson.
The Ketchikan School District Superintendent posted an announcement Friday about the status of the school restructuring plan approved earlier this month. As KRBD's Michael Finelli reports, teachers and administrators will soon learn which school they're assigned to for next year.
The actions taken so far include planning by various departments and open house time for elementary staff to tour the other schools. The restructuring plan combines the district's three elementary schools by grade level, sending kindergarten through third grade students to Fawn Mountain and Point Higgins, and all fourth through sixth graders to Houtling. The geographic dividing line determining whether students attend Fawn Mountain or Point Higgins has been moved a few blocks and is now set at Jefferson Street near Safeway. As the plan will require shuffling of teachers, the superintendent's update says that every elementary staff member has now met with administrators to review their options. They've also had the opportunity to note the building they prefer to work at next year, according to the update. It says teachers will be informed which school they're assigned to by the end of the month, and building administrators will receive assignments the first week of March. Open houses for families to visit schools and meet staff will also be held at some point in the near future. District officials say consolidating students will help cover a roughly $1.7 million budget deficit that's projected to grow in future years. It's also meant to allow for smaller, more evenly distributed class sizes and more focused instruction. The restructuring plan has been met with strong community backlash since it was unveiled in December. The main concerns voiced have been increased distance from schools, the breaking up of families with students in different grades, and compromising the sense of neighborhood schools. Some parents threatened to homeschool their children or leave the community if the plan was enacted. A group of community members recently circulated their own alternate cost-saving proposals on social media. The detailed digital presentation includes multiple options to make up the district's projected budget deficits using what they say are the district's own budget numbers. One plan involves combining some classrooms within the elementary schools, meaning first and second graders in the same class, for example. Another would move all middle schoolers into the high school, which they say has plenty of room. Each plan would move administrators out of the district offices and into schools to help cover for cuts to building-level administrators. The presentation also encourages community members to comment at next week's school board meeting and urges the board to reconsider the restructuring plan. The school board is scheduled to meet next Wednesday, and their published agenda does not currently include any items about the restructuring plan. In Ketchikan, I'm Michael Finelli.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI, keeping schools and students connected across the state with a resilient and redundant network. Details at gci.com/education. How does Alaska's land fund community services for Alaskans with behavioral health conditions and developmental disabilities? Through the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. The Trust Land Office manages 1 million acres of lands to maximize revenue generation, with earnings supporting millions of dollars in trust grant making each year to help improve mental health outcomes for beneficiaries statewide. More at alaskamentalhealthtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
The wide open sky and super flat tundra expanses of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta might not immediately seem connected to elite skiing, but as KYUK's Sage Smiley reports, training on the Kuskokwim River led one Bethel man to a podium finish in a unique world championship event.
The Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta is distinctly short on downhill ski slopes and doesn't have groomed trails for cross-country skiing. If a person on skis wants to go somewhere fast, there is a way, though. The wind.
So it's a way to go skiing out here that It's particularly good for out here.
This is Eric Whitney. He lives here in Bethel. And he's an avid, what he calls, snow kiter. The sport goes by many names.
I always show people a video if they ask, because it's kind of... I have a kite attached to me that can be, you know, 6 meters. It's like a different size kites. And it's attached to a harness. And the kite is up in the air, and it's pulling me around on skis. And I can be on the river or the tundra if there's enough snow.
Whitney says other than traffic on the Kuskokwim Ice Road, the lower river is an ideal place to ski, pulled by a giant kite.
Anywhere else, like in a road system town, there's roads, there's power lines, there's fences, there's rocks, there's trees. We have almost none of that. It's just an amazing area to kite here.
About a decade ago, maybe more, Whitney isn't totally sure, he first clipped into a pair of skis, wrapped a kite cord around his waist, and took off to see if the powerful winds of the YK Delta could take him somewhere. Since then, Whitney has kite-skied all over the region. He'll go in the center of town, locally known as the Donut Hole because there are no roads or buildings there in the middle, or out the ice road on the Kuskokwim River. Once, he hooked up to a kite and skied more than 70 miles downriver to the coastal village of Kongiganak. In early February, Whitney took his relatively solitary passion down south. With a friend, he entered the 2025 Snow and Ice Sailing World Championships in Madison, Wisconsin. Whitney decided, carpe diem.
So I ended up signing up for all the events there as a pro elite kiter, basically, because I'm going to be there all week. And why not?
This was his first ever snow kiting competition of any kind, let alone an elite world championship event. It was set up like a sailing regatta.
Which I also know nothing about.
The format follows sailing closely.
It means a lot of racing.
In both sailing and kite skiing regattas, competitors race multiple times, combining the scores from each race. Throughout the 5-day competition, they race the courses again and again, trying not to get points. The higher you are on the podium after each race, the lower you score. Competitors lined up on the ice of Lake Mendota in Wisconsin, holding their kites back, but jockeying for the best position.
Just starting one of these races looks crazy. There's like 15 kites in the air, and people are posting up, waiting for the start of the race. It's a timed event, and there's snowboarders kind of behind you, and there's all the competitors. It's crazy to see all these kites in the air, and it's really exciting to see that because out here I just see my kite.
Whitney says he entered all the events he could as a kiter with skis.
And then the end of it, they had a marathon event, and that one involved how far can you go in an hour. And initially when I signed up, I'm like, an hour for a marathon? That doesn't sound like much. But after you've been there for a week, I was quite tired. An hour sounded like a long time.
For the marathon event, Whitney says his friend loaned him some longer skis and a less cumbersome kite. And he got the advantage of some Kuskokwim-esque weather.
The storm blows in and I was like, oh, it feels normal. it's blasting and it's totally icy. And yeah, that seemed pretty normal.
All those hours training on the blustery Kuskokwim, plus a pair of skis he could hold an edge on, gave a very different feeling to the marathon race.
I think when I noticed I was passing the guys that I could barely keep in sight in the other races, that was a moment.
And Whitney ended up making the podium in his first snow kite competition, a world championship.
On the other courses, I was happy to get around the course at all. So to come in third, I was thrilled. So I'm pretty excited about it.
Next, Whitney says he'll be returning to familiar stomping grounds, the annual snow kite festival at Thompson Pass near Valdez in April. And after that, who knows? A big kite and a pair of skis can take you a lot of places. In Bethel, I'm Sage Smiley.
After 3 grueling weeks on trail, a dog musher from Maine completed a symbolic reenactment of 1925 Serum Run that's credited with saving Nome from diphtheria. He arrived in Nome Tuesday, 3 weeks after departing from Nenana, and as KNOM's Ben Townsend tells us, his dog team has a special connection to the original race to save Nome.
Under the glow of multicolored lights strung across Nome's front street, musher Jonathan Nathaniel Hayes and his dog team come to a halt. After 23 days on the trail, Hayes instinctively sets down his snow hooks, which bounce off the icy road. Despite just completing a 750-mile run from Nenana to Nome, his 16-dog team veers to the left as the snow hooks uselessly slide across the road. Hayes' crew rushes to secure both ends of the line as he digs into his sled, unfurling a blanket containing an antique wooden box. Nome's mayor, John Handlin, steps forward.
The mayor of Nenana asked me to send this, to deliver this to you. Inside is not only a vial for every one of the 9 pandemics that have hit Alaska, but in this envelope are letters from the children of Nenana to the children of Nome.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for bringing it.
Handlin accepts the box as children rush to pet the black and white Siberian huskies. But the journey from Nenana to Nome, like the legendary one 100 years ago, wasn't without its challenges.
Everyone was telling us the villagers aren't even traveling right now between villages. There's no trail. There's overflow. You can't start on January 27th. But that's the centennial date. That's what we came here to do.
Also connecting Hayes to the original run are his 16 Siberian Huskies, all direct descendants of Leonard Seppala's dog team. The Norwegian was a resident of Nome and played a crucial role in delivering the life-saving diphtheria serum.
So they were coming home. It was really surreal that Leonard Seppala, after the serum run, brought his dogs to Nome. And then 100 years later, I brought those dogs back to Nome from Maine.
Hayes says the toughest challenge came in the final few days between White Mountain and Nome, where the team braved Norden Sound's notoriously relentless coastal winds. The infamous Topcock blowhole east of Solomon, known for its unpredictable typhoon-force winds, nearly halted the team's progress. As temperatures plummeted to negative 50, the team took shelter in a small trapper cabin. The biology teacher by trade says he worried for the health of his dogs.
They're going to hunker down. They're going to be completely comfortable under that snow, and they're going to be fine. But my heart was like, what if I wake up in the morning and I've got a frozen dog?
Unable to sleep, Hayes decided to bring all 16 dogs into the tiny cabin. To his surprise, they seemed fine outside.
And when I did, they looked at me like, seriously, dude, I was sleeping and you brought me back into this, blizzard again? Really?
100 years, almost to the day, the team began the final stretch into Nome with a fire orange sunset ahead. On Front Street, Amy Nichols waits on the sidewalk. Her husband is a member of Hayes' support team and should be riding into town on a snow machine anytime now. She says the team considered mushing the Iditarod Trail, but decided on the serum run to pay homage to the kennel's rare bloodline.
Anyone can do the Iditarod. Not everybody can recreate the serum run with Togo's lineage. So it's cool to be here. And, obviously we would follow them out here and be here for this moment.
Hayes said he feels called to preserve that Seppala Siberian sled dog lineage. He says of the 100 or so of these dogs left, he has 22. The team's next mushing event is the Can-Am 250 sled dog race back in Maine. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Townsend.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Ashlyn O'Hara in Soldotna, Theo Greenlee in Unalaska, Jack Darrell and Michael Finelli in Ketchikan, Melinda Munson in Skagway, Sage Smiley in Bethel, and Ben Townsend in Nome. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training. ConocoPhillips Alaska, committed to Alaska for more than 50 years.
Join Alaska's only statewide live call-in forum to discuss the issues affecting your life, from politics to science and culture. That's Talk of Alaska, weekly on your local public radio station.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
when she touched me, I was ready to die. I've never been fatal, you're my first time. I feel like an angel who just started to fly. Well, you got a way that you're making me feel. I can feel I can do it.
Your pocket, not one penny. don't have many. When you get back on your feet again, everybody wants to be your long lost friend. I said it straight.
Thank you. gentleman. If anybody can fit the description, baby, I can. Someone who cares and dares to give himself completely. You got it in me. You need a man with sensitivity.
You need a man.
Stand and be strong. No one ever gives up.